Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and welcome to the program. As always, I am joined by my most excellent panel from the flourishing metropolis of Youngstown, Ohio. We have author, activist, and teacher Sam Moffey. Sam, welcome.
Hey, Simon. It's a pleasure to be here. Happy Mother's Day and to all, and I'm looking forward for a great show. As usual, we solve all the world's problems, and at least we forget Vladimir Putin had a mother, too.
Right. Yeah. Even Put-Put has a mom. And from the City of Angels, attorney, modern-day reinvention of Perry Mason, Peter Haven. Peter, it is always good to talk to you.
Well, likewise, and thank you very much for that introduction. I'll do my best to try to live up to it, and we'll see if we can straighten a few things out in the world and keep the City of Angels what it's supposed to be, but frequently is not.
Right. I am expecting a couple of other people to call in, but, well, they're notoriously late. So let's get started. And I thought we could kick off with a couple of sports-related topics. My stepson has been glued to the TV watching the yawn-inducing NFL draft. And I sat here and watched it, and I thought it was such a shame that Bud Light sponsor it. From a marketing perspective, the Miller Brewing Company would be a much better choice. They could call it the Miller Draft.
That's a good one.
The only interesting part that I found, because I really don't follow football, was that, you know, who was going to take Michael Sams? While personally, I don't give a damn about a person's sexual preferences, men, women, sheep. You know, I'm curious, though, you know, does the Michael Sams story signify that the NFL is now gay-friendly? Peter, you're a sports fan. What do you think?
Well, it signifies that there is a new chapter in the NFL, and the new chapter is that we have the first openly gay player in the NFL. I believe that he is not the first gay player in the NFL. I believe there have been a number of others, and for whatever reason, they didn't open it up to the general public. And, you know, my perception on this as far as the NFL locker rooms are concerned, from a corporate and marketing standpoint, from an NFL administrative standpoint, the message is clear. Yes, we are gay friendly, but as far as the locker rooms are concerned, that's a different battleground. And, you know, we've already had at least one player from the infamous Miami Dolphins who's been reprimanded for tweeting negative commentary about the fact that he was drafted. And that's a separate battleground. And my impression of how that battleground will play out is if his teammates believe that he contributes to making the team better, then they will literally embrace him with open arms. And if they feel like he's not making the team better, then I think there'll be some semblance of a backlash against him. And it's just it's to be expected, and it's just part of the ever-evolving process of making the NFL more like the rest of the world, which is tolerant of all kinds of people and different persuasions. I do think it's significant that he was drafted in the seventh round, and I do think it's significant that he was essentially drafted by his home team. He played at the University of Missouri, and St. Louis is the one that drafted him, and I think to a certain extent it was a token gesture by St. Louis to draft him at the end of the draft to kind of make a statement that you know, they were willing to accept him, and they wanted to make a gesture to a local player. I don't know what his long-term NFL career will be, given the fact that so many teams passed on him. I think most scouts think that he's not that great a player, but we have a new chapter in history right now. We have the first openly gay athlete on an NFL football team, even though I don't think he's the first one.
Okay. Before we move on, we got someone calling in from the mysterious 111 area code, and I have a suspicion that it might be either Gary Penn or Manny Barling.
Oh, my.
The last person who called me mysterious, I punched. So Manny. In trouble.
Manny, the sound of your voice always warms me up inside. I get warm and fuzzy feeling. Good to hear from you.
Hello, Peter. How are you, my friend? Is Sam with us, too?
I'm here.
Oh, yeah.
Happy Mother's Day, Manny. Your mother?
Thank you. I've been a mother for a long time. Thank you. It's nice to be on the show. And Simon, I hope you're having a nice Mother's Day at your house, and I'm surprised Jan allowed you to be on the show today.
Manny, obviously he, hold on. I think we might have another person on the line. Again, coming in from the mysterious 111 area code, would this be Gary?
It is, Simon. You have me for a little bit today.
Okay.
God bless America. We're all united.
All right.
Happy Mother's Day, Gary.
Hello, hello. Hello, one and all.
Okay. I'm going to start this segment again, if you will.
Simon, I'm going to jump in on Peter's tail because I heard enough of what Peter said, and I'll just pick up the mantle, and Gary will just catch on. I don't agree, Peter. I think that Michael Sam's problem was he wasn't tall enough, and too much public appearances and other things. He was out of shape at the combine and other things that limited his performance, but I saw him play quite a bit at Missouri, and he has the ability to be a very, very good defensive end in a 4-3 system. He could not play in a 3-4 system, which is three down linemen and four linebackers. And Dave Copay, who oddly enough was my brother's classmate at Notre Dame High School in Sherman Oaks, was the first acknowledged gay football player in the NFL. Everyone knew he was gay, but the public apparently didn't figure it out until he wrote a memoir a year or two after he retired. He played for the Washington Redskins. I don't know if anyone here remembers him or not.
What was his name, Manny?
Dave Copay, K-O-P-A-Y. His older brother, Tony, was a good football player, both of them at the University of Washington. And Tony went on to coach in college ranks for about 20 years. But Dave Copay and Tom Vondre, the heir to the Vons Market and his fortune, and my older brother used to drive to high school every day, and I knew him quite well. And by the time he started college, we all thought he was gay, and I don't know anybody in his, that played with him in high school college or in the NFL didn't know he was gay. He didn't hide it at all.
Gary, the question I asked was, has the NFL changed their tune on, openly gay players with the announcement of, the draft of Michael Sam's?
Yeah, I'm sure they have. I believe in evolution and I believe in devolution. It depends. There's two Americas now, and I think it's just been a slow, inching forward. It's in the culture now. It's not so as taboo. It's not so strange. It isn't so much the NFL. It's the players, and the players seem to be more forgiving and more comfortable. They see it, people getting married, they see it on television. So it seems to be less of a threat to these men's masculinity. I think that they're not afraid that these men are going to do a reach around in the shower. So I think everyone's feeling a little safer.
And Sam, your thoughts?
Gee, Manny, you blew me away. I thought it was Roberto Muldoon who was the first gay football player.
He was not that far after him.
Anyway, I think it was great. Peter, you brought up a great point that the Rams drafted him. Great public relations move for them. And good for the NFL. I've heard, being an NFL fan, because we got the Browns got Johnny Football, which was incredible hype in Cleveland and whatnot, maybe, which is a graveyard for quarterbacks over the last 25 years. We thought there was a big rumor going around that, because the season ticket sales just went off the roof for the Browns, who have been terrible the last 10 years, that they were going to draft Michael Sams, because they had a seventh pick, and just to get more hype and more national attention and all that, and it was incredible what was going on in all the blogs and the Browns and things of that nature. It was pretty interesting. But everybody had positive comments and whatnot, but most people said the guy did really good when he played football at Missouri, but is he going to make it as the NFL? Only time will tell, just like all the other people who were drafted. I mean, there's some people who are drafted, who are first-round draft picks, number ones, who are bust outs, and there's some people who are drafted in the seventh round who become all-pros. There's some people who are not even drafted who become fabulous players. So whether you're gay or not, whatnot, it's going to be what happens when he gets onto the football field is going to determine it. What I think is going to be interesting is, what if he's not that good and the Rams have to cut him because he just isn't that good? Is there going to be backlash from the gay gay groups that, oh, they cut him because he's gay, or he couldn't cut it? And then other hate groups might say, see, gay people can't make it. I mean, is that irrelevant? I don't know.
Well, I think I think that the NFL wanted him to be drafted, and I think that, I believe St. Louis made the gesture since he was a local player, and it is an open question. There were commentators talking about it this morning about whether or not he will make the team, and if he makes the team, great, mission accomplished, and if he doesn't make the team, I think people will say, well, you can't blame the Rams. They drafted him, and if they don't sign him to a contract, they obviously took the chance in drafting him, and if they don't think he makes the squad, then I think they're protected. So I think it's set up so that it will just strictly be a football decision, and there may be a backlash, but how can you fault the Rams? They drafted him. How can they be blamed?
Right.
I think there's a bigger issue that everybody's missing. The owner of the Rams is Stan Kroenke. Stan Kroenke is married to Ann Walton, one of Walton's daughters, and a billionaire herself. They're both billionaires. And, Walton's, I have a long history of fundamentalist Christian beliefs and being anti-gay, and this is somewhat of a surprise for the Waltons. And interestingly enough, and I'm sure that Sam agrees with his thought, had they been drafted by Jacksonville, which is in northern Florida, which is the heartbed of fundamentalist Christian movement in Florida, that might have been a little different kind of scenario. Even though Kansas is conservative, Kansas City itself and St. Louis are not considered conservative towns. And Sam, I think you'll agree, Jacksonville might have been a tougher place for him.
Sure, I think so. I mean, to be honest with you, I was shocked the Jets and Giants didn't draft him. I mean, or San Francisco. I mean, just because they have larger gay populations, it would have been great marketing for them. Probably would have, you know, I mean, would have, as a defensive end on the 49ers, you would have had a tough time making that team. They're loaded. But the Jets, who are in need of an image remake and this and that, from pure standpoints of that, I really thought that, and I believed he was going to get drafted. I was kind of shocked he was drafted by the St. Louis, St. Louis Rams. You know, I really saw him going to the Giants or the Jets, and the marketing skills would have been fabulous. My son covers the Brooklyn. You know, and even though Jason Collins isn't playing that much, the PR they've been able to get out of that in the NBA for them has been a real shot in the arm for them. So, I mean, I'm just looking at it from purely hype standards. But, hey, he is where he is, and I wish him the best of luck, and we'll see what happens.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the second sports story that, I'm not really sure it's a sports story, but the NBA... the Clippers. The Sterling story just keeps getting better. I see a real legal morass here. Shelley Sterling wants to hold on to the team. Can she do it? Manny, you know, what's your thoughts?
Well, Peter, I hope will weigh in on this, too. The Clippers are in the family trust. And oddly enough, she has a community property interest in the team. And even though Donald Sterling may have made a mess of things, she hasn't. And the NFL is going to be hard-pressed to divest her of her interest. And I will consider this strategy, because I've used another work. And, Peter, I'm interested in your opinion. What if Don Sterling withdraws from management, makes her the operating officer or the trustee, and withdraws as co-trustee of their family trust, and she becomes the single operating officer under the trust? I think they have a legal problem in the state of California removing her from owning the Clippers and operating the family trust if Don Sterling has no involvement whatsoever. And as a brief aside, I don't think she can handle the market, and I think this is just a little above her capabilities, frankly. And I'll quit there. So how do you feel about that, Peter?
Well, I think that you're absolutely right in terms of who owns the team, but I think the flip side of the equation is you can own the team all you want. I could own the local softball team. But what makes the team valuable is its membership in the National Basketball Association. And to me, it doesn't matter who the owner is. To me, I believe that the NBA owners probably have the ability to take a franchise out of the league. And I don't know the documents and the contractual agreements, but it seems to me that the NBA owners have the ability to say, well, this city gets a franchise and this city doesn't get a franchise. And if the NBA owners say, as long as the Sterlings own the Clippers aren't going to be part of the NBA, then there's a power play, there's a problem. And I think this was the exact same thing that the Major League Baseball did to the Dodgers. They basically put pressure on the ownership to sell out. And I think that the NBA will have the ability to say, you know, you can own the Clippers all you want, but if the Clippers aren't in the NBA, you're not going to own anything. And so that's where the power play will come. And one way or another, I believe the NBA will win, but I do believe it's going to be a big legal clash, and it'll probably take a year or so at least to sort out.
Oh, yeah, that would be quick in our state.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Dodgers, it seems like the Dodgers got resolved in about a year or so, but there were extenuating factors there. For one thing, the team was apparently on the verge of bankruptcy. It couldn't meet its payroll, and then the other factor was that the McCourts themselves were going through a divorce, and these additional problems put pressure on the franchise and put pressure on the ownership to basically give in. The Clippers, I assume, are in financially good shape, and they're obviously a successful team. So I think it'll be a different kind of legal battle. But I'm just not an expert enough on how these battles shape out. I can see Al Davis fighting for years against the NFL, and it seems to me some battles he won and some battles he lost. But I just fundamentally believe that if the NBA doesn't want to have a franchise in its fold, it will have the ability to push it out. And I don't think they want to do that. I think they just want to use that as leverage to get new ownership.
Okay, let me ask the other two guests to jump in. Gary, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I always have thoughts. I don't think it's good, as smart as the other two just now. I could only go from a non-legal position. You know, the whole thing is just galling. The whole thing of, you know, how many of us say things in our own homes, or in our, you know, if we say things in our own minds, like. For all of, I think most of the panel are Caucasian. So how would you feel if your son or daughter was saying, I'm going to marry this black person? Now, I think most of us would be just fine and we'd be fine, but we may have a reaction and we may say something to our spouse or to our friends that may sound really crappy. It doesn't sound like, it sounds like Donald Sterling is a racist and is, kind of a sick man, but I'm just saying there's that part of it that's kind of galling a little bit, kind of frustrating. The other part is, I don't know, I think he should just go away. I think they should all just go away and live the rest of their lives, you know, in the Caribbean, drinking wine and doing what they need to do just to get through the day. But it's
I think, Gary, I don't know you, but I think we should be doing that.
Amen, Manny.
And Sam, your opening volley.
Send in the lawyers. Send in the lawyers. Send in the lawyers. No offense to the two esteemed lawyers on the panel. But
hey, I wish somebody would hire me to go in there. I would love that gig.
Oh, how much money are the lawyers going to make from all three sides, right?
$50 million. Since I'm the only one that shows ever represented an NBA team, let me offer you guys some insight. This is one of the most interesting things about Donald Sterling. The last 20 years, he's probably the only owner that has shown a profit every single year. And one of the reasons is because Donald is taking the cheap way out every single time. It happens to gall every owner in the NBA. I think he may be the single most unpopular owner in the NBA from my experiences. But every one of them have commented to me at one time or another, but he's making money. And so Don refused to sign a lot of people. And I say Don because I've known him for close to 40 years. Actually, it's more than 40 now. And he just runs everything based upon profit. He's an extraordinarily shrewd businessman, always has been. When I met him, he was just a personal injury attorney. I was starving through law school, and frankly, I used to send him cases. And to make a long story short, his life revolves around this team. He's really got nothing else to do. He's bored. And I believe, and my wife has said this a number of times, because my wife knows Shelley very well. They belong to a number of Beverly Hills clubs together, that these two have nothing else to do, and they will just die without it. And if Don loses the team, it will shorten his life by a large amount, and that would be sad. And the last comment I want to make is he's extraordinarily litigious. He fights everything to the end. And he's such a problem in court that a number of years ago he had a case that I don't want to mention, but in the long run, what happened is the presiding judge in Los Angeles became so disgusted with him, he assigned Lester Olson as the special master. And Lester Olson's father served on the Supreme Court. Lester served on the Supreme Court. And in my youth, in the 70s, was the premier judge in L.A. Superior Court before he was nominated to the appeals court. So the judge was so concerned about his nature, that was the step that he took. So I expect he'll say to himself, God, you know, I can litigate this for 5 or 6 years and still hold on to the team. and he will consider that. I know he's seen John Quinn at Quinn and Emanuel already. Had a number of people call me and tell me he was in the office. And so he's scouting. He's looking for a good attorney. He also saw Bertrand Fields, you know, who's one of the top entertainment lawyers in the state of California, who's married to one of the Guggenheims. So he's been out making the rounds already.
So
every lawyer he meets with will tell him exactly what he wants to hear, which is, if you pay me a lot of money, I'll help you win. And, you know, I don't know if that's necessarily true. And the NBA will win if he stays on the sidelines and there's some interim executive who's running the franchise for 4 or 5 years. Even if the NBA does that, that will be a victory.
Well, they did that. Yes, they did that over the weekend. They appointed some ex.
Well, if that interim CEO, the guy who was formerly the head of Time Warner, if he stays in power for 3 or 4 or 5 years while this thing gets litigated, then the NBA will win.
Sure. Yeah. And at that point, he won't pursue it any longer.
Right.
Yeah, well, he may not even be alive.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing is, I'm sure at one point in time he was a shrewd businessman, but he himself admitted that he made a poor business decision by not just paying her off. So
I've had a number of clients make that decision, and it's a terrible mistake. And you say that to him. I said to him, how much is this battle worth? But that wasn't the undoing. The undoing was Shelley got disgusted with her and sued her. And the minute she sued her, it all started to come out, and the retaliation started. And, you know, when you have wealthy people who are sued by people who have no money and nothing to lose, and they get in these kind of fights, those people always revert to these kind of disclosures because they have no other manner of fighting. Right, Peter?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I guess the point of all that is that even the super wealthy people who have everything at their disposal, they can get petty. And when they get petty, it all starts to crumble. And that's what's happening.
Well, I can tell you from experience that all of my millionaire and billionaire clients over a period of time never changed their spots. One of them, who owned a professional baseball team that I represented, wouldn't even tip. He was born and raised in the Depression in Brooklyn, and he just didn't tip people. And he never changed. When he was worth $10 billion, he still didn't tip people. And
he sounds like a wonderful guy.
He was.
Well, you know what? You know what? Back in the day, I used to crap my pants, but I learned a thing or two. And just because someone says he does it that way doesn't make it right.
Yeah, I agree.
It's not that. It's just that, you know, people are who they are. And I remember a story. I was in Toronto with his father. So now here's the father whose son was a tailor. His son is now this billionaire. And we go to this deli. They wanted $12 for a corned beef sandwich. And he refused to order a corned beef sandwich. It cost $12.
Well, you know, on the other side of it is I'm in the business of change. People come to me all the time because they picked the wrong person to marry, because they can't get in good relationships, because their career's failing, and they change, and they work hard. And they say, you know what, just because things were back then, like tomorrow does not have to be like today, and today doesn't have to be like yesterday. So just because someone says, I am that way, whether that's Clive and Bundy or the person who owns a baseball team, doesn't make it okay. And, of course, if you have $10 billion, you have plenty of resources to pay someone like me to make you better.
Well, I'm not
the other
saying
thing,
okay, Gary. Yeah. What I'm saying is they are who they are, and because of that, they have that amount of money, they have very little motivation to change who they are.
I understand, I don't think it's outrageous.
One of the things that strikes me about these kinds of people is some people say, well, look how penny wise he is and how thrift he is, but I see something else. I see people who have a paranoid obsession with money, and they believe that a dollar in their pocket makes them a dollar better as a human being. And they covet every nickel, every dime, every penny, because they believe it's like points in the column of life. And I view their stinginess as a kind of paranoid obsession that they think that if they let go of even one penny, somehow they're losing some element of themselves, and they completely view themselves as a function of their money. They think that if they have $1 billion, that makes them a billion times better than any other human being on life. And they view themselves solely and exclusively as a function of their money. And I think that one of the things that this demonstrates is if people decide that they hate you and you slip up, they will all jump on you and attack you. And that's what's happening with Donald Sterling right now. I mean, he what he did wasn't that big a deal. But he's had a lot of enemies building up over the years, and they just waited for this, and now they're pouncing like some pack.
Oh, Manny, tell me it's not so. I mean, I thought Donald Sterling had a Sterling reputation.
Mr. Pundit.
Yes. He has aggravated a great many people, and you know, not long ago I sat with him at a charity event at dinner, and Don managed to aggravate several people at the table with no effort whatsoever. But you know, coming back to what Peter said, I happen to agree. One of the most common things that was said to me by very wealthy people, and I will include Bill Gates, who said this once to me. He said basically, money is the score of the game. He said that's how you can tell whether you're winning and losing. And so to a great extent, they view the money as a way of telling whether they're winning or losing, and they see life through winning and losing. And that's why they believe belong seeing Gary, is because that's not an attitude that leads to a very healthy life. And that's one of Sterling's problems. Yes, I agree.
Peter, I think that was a very, and we probably all know people like that at various degrees of wealth in the system, and I do too. And not only do they see it as they're better than you because they have more money than you or feel that much better about themselves, they have to continue to go out and, like Manny said, get more to win. And I also think they have a real misguided viewpoint that they can buy a U-Haul while they're dying and take it with them to heaven. And wherever they're going to be going, I think it's amazing to me how people operate that way, but they do. But I thought it's interesting with Sterling, what all you guys are saying is, what really makes it, to me, what I thought the most, the two things that stand out in my mind. One, what are the other 29 owners going to do? Because as Mark Cuban said, it's a slippery slope, and I do see what he was saying. I mean,
yeah.
You know, with that. Are they going to vote him out when push comes to shove? Because they could be next. It could be something else could happen. They could get caught in a gotcha moment, too, and they don't want to lose their franchises. And, or the other thing I want to say, what sums up society to me is, if Donald Sterling's a man, you sent me an email, the guy's, you know, it's his whole life, the Clippers, he's racist, everyone else has come up with all this stuff about him, but because of his money and because of what he owned, he literally bought the NAACP Lifetime Achievement Award in that chapter over there. And that, to me, is just so sums up what's wrong with this country, that people with wealth and power and things of that nature, even though they're racist, terrible, but because they can get the dough and they got the right position in society or they own the right property, are able to steer awards in their favor to, as Peter, you said, to make him feel even more even happier about himself. Look at this great award I got, even though I don't like black people. They gave it to me.
Gary, have you noticed and I know Peter probably has, the number of ads that he runs particularly in the Sunday paper, average.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah,
all the time.
Yeah, and by the way, that picture of him is about 30 years old. And really. And but what's interesting about that is it goes to his ego. He can't even allow a picture to be used showing him at a younger age. So, but why does he do that? Because he's seeking some type of attention and all these things that Gary sees patients for, I'm sure. So, yeah, I think that's one of his problems. And yes, I also agree with what Peter said. There's a certain, Sam said about they want to take their money with them. And the hardest thing for an older man to deal with when they're at that age is what to do with their money and who to leave it to.
Well, my idea for him would be, you know, what my thought is that he needs a heart transplant the way Ebenezer Scrooge needs a heart transplant. and he figured out, you know, at the end of days, and I think you should, you know, really, not because this is, I'm aiming the bar high, but he should build a big, you know, some big apartment units in South Central and East L.A., and he should be in the leasing also. He should see the families that rent out these places. And he should kind of, like, you know, get some humanity. And if it's a PR stunt, I don't care. But I think that that would serve him well, whether or not he owns the Clippers. I mean, I think it might be a good use of his time and money.
Good luck. Good luck. By the way, I come back to your comments about Mark Cuban. First of all, whoever thought Mark Cuban would start sounding like a good that, that's the first thought. And the second one is, yeah, it is a slippery slope for the owners because Simon pointed out to me not too long ago and reminded me that the DeVos family owns the Orlando Magic, and if you know anything about them, they're basically right-wing extremists who fund charter schools and God knows what else that only teach Christian ideals that they believe in, and only if they will hire professors who agree with what they have to say, which is something Bill Gates has been doing a lot of also. So, yeah, so what becomes a fireable offense? I mean, you know, at what point? And again, back to the Walton family, their record isn't exactly sterling on the position.
No, I know, and I think so. I don't think that the owners, because of what, and we don't know the other, I mean, could even tell, name majority of the owners in the NBA, but I guarantee you that all of them have their skeletons in their closet, and they might be saying, when they take that vote, it'll be in secrecy, obviously, and I don't think they have the vote to take him out based upon their own fears and whatnot, and unless things drastically change and some major arm twisting goes in, no matter how bad Sterling's hated because of what you just said, Manny. Look at some of these people. There's a Boots family. I know them because they're, you know, the Lakers. I don't even know who owns the Celtics anymore. I don't even know who owns it. And there's another, you know, it could be anything else they could take out. What if one starts to have... just who are these people? I mean, they're all obviously wealthy, wealthy people, and if we're going by what we're all agreeing to today, that they all are narcissistic, majority of them have so much money they think they're better than everybody, they've got major skeletons in their closets, and they may get caught in that gotcha moment, and they could lose their toy, and they probably wouldn't want that to happen.
Come back to this story, but seeing as I have Manny, Peter, and Gary on the line, they're all in L.A., how about the Beverly Hills Hilton? And if you haven't heard the story, you must have had your head in the sand.
Well, what about... Yep. The Sultan of
Brunei. I had my head in the sand.
The Sultan of Brunei has gone to Sharia law. I almost fell over laughing. You know, that's sort of like the ultimate hedonist suddenly saying I'm going straight. I mean, it's not like these guys are there, but it's hard for me. I spent a lot of time at the Hotel Bel Air. I started going there as a child to weddings since I grew up here. And it's one of my favorite places in the world, including almost every place in Europe. And it disturbed me. It was first bought by the sisters of the Hunt sisters. You know, the Hunts owned with the big silver dealers and active during the Vietnam War. And then they sold it to Sultan of Brunei, and it was just really very annoying, except he came in and spent about $40 billion remodeling, and it's the most beautiful place you've ever seen. Yeah, they won't change. They will, and the people who stay at that hotel, what they pay for a room, they won't care. Now, Peter, do you know what this is about, or are you just joking?
I am very sorry to admit that I am one of those people who does not get out that much, and I did have my head in the sand, and I have no idea what's going on with that hotel. So I admit it. It's right here, and I'm some clueless guy who's out of touch with reality. Fill me in, gentlemen.
Okay, Manny, I'll let you give the narrative.
Basically, Brunei has decided to go to Sharia law, which we know is the oldest form of law in Islam, and basically Sharia law denies rights to women as the basis of all fundamentalist Muslim movements. So it was actually stunning to me. I mean, as I said to you, of all the people, it'd be all of a sudden like the Saudis, you know, who are really anti-Sharia law also changing too. So suddenly all the gay lesbian groups in L.A., of which we have probably more than the rest of the world combined, decided to jump up and say, let's boycott the hotel because, after all, they're what they believe in is against anyone who's gay. So it became a of course, we have to understand, for those who are not aware, Beverly Hills is adjacent to West L.A., and once you cross Doheny, you're in Boys Town, as it was once called. So that proximity just prompted all sorts of protests because, guess what, it's a short drive. And I understand you live in Beverly Hills, Gary, so you understand that short drive. No comment, I say.
Gary's driving right now. He's going to go protest.
Right. I think he just dropped off the switchboard.
Probably doesn't like two lawyers in the same spot at the same time.
Right. Well,
can't blame him. I won't have lunch with two lawyers. Will you, Peter?
Not if I can't. Not if I don't have to. No.
Okay. Here he is.
I want to. You got to get him to comment first because he's out there.
He is the Sultan of Brunei. Let's take a poll. Would he vote Republican or Democrat?
Why? Well, not Republican supporter.
Yeah, of course. Because all the crazies these days are Republicans. Thank you very much. That's my comment.
Could the Sultan buy the Clippers? How come he hasn't thrown his turban into the ring to buy the Clippers?
I don't know, but there would be women in the very top with wearing burqas. If you really think about it, and you look at really the fundamentalist Christians and the crazy Christians. Even the Orthodox Jews wouldn't be too far. They're not that far away from Sharia law. You know, we sit here on our high horse and we make fun of this and think it's kind of kooky. But if you really get into the nuts and bolts of the fundamentalist movements, not that far away at all.
Oh, no.
Oh, okay. Well, I live in the Bible Belt, shall we say.
No. You live in the Bible. You don't live in the Bible.
Right.
Bible.
You know, there hasn't been a good public stoning in ages here in Picayune.
That's surprising. No, you know, Gary, what I was saying before about it is that it's so shocking because the history of Brunei is Islamism, and it's really hard to understand where this is coming from and this sudden desire to become more conservative. And the difference between all the religious fundamentalists are the only two who really actively kill people, believe it or not, are the Christian fundamentalists, but they usually prefer to burn people at the stake, and of course Islam. But the rest of the fundamentalists just want to be left alone. Certainly fundamentalist Jews would just want to be left alone, yeah.
Yes, very, very, very true, but I tell you this, thank God George W. Bush lit the Arab Spring so democracy is spreading like wildfire in the Middle East. Thank God for his prescience, his brilliance, his geopolitical acumen. This is the smartest guy. He should be on Rushmore, believe me.
Well, yeah, you know, he will go down as the worst president of the United States since Harding, and he's going to compete with a few others. And I laugh every time that Bush stands up and says, I'm going to let history decide my destiny. I'm going to
start
laughing. Gary, one of my strengths is history. I just finished a book on economics and history, and I guarantee you they are not going to treat him very nicely.
Well, did you read what's going on in Kansas right now where they're broke, and now Missouri's doing the same thing because they just keep on lowering taxes, and they're all Moody's just downgraded them. It's just awful.
Well, the interesting thing about Kansas is they have been trying to deny school systems money, and they were ordered by the court to change their system by this coming July. And what they did is they passed a series of laws that allow expensive schools to raise money. They diverted the money from the poorer schools and entered into this huge charade and basically did it at midnight after the press left the meeting. And if you guys want to read a good story, just Google the fight between the school system and the other groups in Kansas, and you can see why they're having trouble.
Yeah, well, they also believe in they also teach creationism, I think, there.
Well, that is, no, they just bar other people from teaching Darwin. And by the way, Mississippi has done the same thing. Mississippi passed a law about teaching, basically sex education that basically made it virtually impossible to teach creationism. You can keep your kids at home now. And they don't, if I'm correct, am I correct, Simon, they don't even allow boys and girls in the same sex education class anymore.
Oh, I don't know. I know is I got my sex education the hard way.
Another Simon pun.
Yeah.
Well said, sir.
We both had British parents, and I understand that one. But I remember once in my life I asked my mother a question about sex. And my mother said to me, oh, when you're married, it comes naturally. Oh, really? you want to reflect on that one, Gary? It comes naturally, and your marriage just works when you know nothing, right?
I'm a big believer in that, yes. Let's just play blind man's bluff with our clothes off.
Okay.
What happened.
All right. A story I have never told. I was 18, and I invited my then girlfriend to come spend the night. You know, parents owned a bed and breakfast, and so yeah, life is good. Of course, I overslept, and my father, being the always keen hotel keeper, knocked on the door and walked in with a cup of tea, because that's the polite thing to do in the UK back then. And he looked around, and he all he said was, "Oh, I should have brought two cups of tea."
Yeah. Well done.
That is just adorable. That is just cute as a button. My goodness.
You're not in Kansas anymore, because in the U.S. that would have probably caused a lynching. I had that happen, only my parents were supposed to be in Las Vegas and came home a day early and found me in their bed with somebody, and they were not the happiest campers in the world, although they never said a word to me about it. I don't know why. I kept waiting for them to murder me, and they were British and polite to say anything.
You understand that when you guys are lucky you were caught by your parents. I got caught by my girlfriend's father. That was not pleasant. I'm surprised I still live. I'm surprised I'm still alive.
I am too.
That was a rough one.
I can only assume
especially
a card-carrying member of the NRA.
Man, you brought up a great point. I was in my girlfriend's parents' bedroom, just like you were in your parents' bedroom, and it's like it's okay. But from my point of view, who cared, right? I was just getting laid. But if you really think about it, you know, it's okay to be in your own parents' bedroom, but to be in your girlfriend's parents' bedroom, especially when the dad walked in, that was bad.
That's not a great idea, no.
No. Instant.
Oh, yeah.
That's like an anti-Viagra.
Yeah. That was too bad I didn't have it back then. I would have loved it. I don't think I would have ever came out of my room. But as far as those Kansas goes, Manny and Gary and Peter and Simon, I don't think it's been the same ever since Quantrell left, you know?
I thought you were going to say Dorothy for a moment.
Yeah, so, but, no, that's terrible about the states and the teaching, being a teacher and all that. And, you know, the thing that's coming around now that, just to throw it on a sidebar, and I don't know how you three gentlemen feel about it, I'm just starting to get to know about it from other teachers, is this core that's going around, that some of the teachers I talk to and administrators love it, and the other ones absolutely despise it. And it's, but man, you know what, you know what it's not addressing, core? The digital technology, that book that I've been reading, Digital Natives versus Digital Digital Immigrants for today's Teaching. The core isn't doing that. It's really just core curriculum, and it just, it's an opportunity with the way, because education is funded now, to really do something about the technology, and it's not. You know, and that's my criticism of it.
You know,
okay,
Sam.
Let me tell you, Sam.
About page 20, the chapter on education I sent you to read starts on Common Core, which is funded by Bill Gates almost entirely, and there's a rebellion in New York against it. It's spawned a slew of online schools, which you'll find are the last five pages from 33 to page 40 in what I sent you, and everything you want to know about online and charter schools and Common Core you'll find in that chapter.
Well, I look forward to it. I'm still in chapter two. You know, I told you after I read three of your pages, I have to lie down and comprehend it all.
Okay.
Sam,
a real serious question.
Okay.
You know, we've been told that STEM is the way to go, and I personally hate it. Right? It's important to know, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic, but I think it's also equally important to have social skills. Are you finding STEM to be an issue?
Yes, no, it all depends, you know, like everything else, it all depends, and I agree with you. But, I mean, what I'm learning from my vast, diverse, you know, public education and some private schools with young kids, and remember, I'm the substitute, so I get a lesson plan most of the time. Good teachers leave me a good lesson plan. Bad teachers don't give a shit and make me put a DVD movie in that I got to watch seven times straight. You know, they just don't. You can tell they're bored. They shouldn't be teaching anymore. They just, you know, and I start looking at all the lesson plans. They have kids watching DVDs all the time. Oh, we're studying the Holocaust? Watch Schindler's List. You know, I mean, there's more to it than that. You know, oh, we're studying the American Revolution, social studies, watch John Adams. Not that that's not bad, but it's all they do. It's all these kids do, and the teachers just lost that. But I agree with you with the social thing. You know, I think what I'm learning, and I got to tip my hat to Manny because he turned me on to this educator who's written these books, is, you know, if you really think about it, regardless of what we're teaching in Youngstown, your town, Manny, Peter, so all the public schools, you know, the private schools, it's when the kids are out of school, the stuff they're learning, the stuff they are exposed to through the digital, being digital natives. My 7-year-old granddaughter can run my cell phone better than I can with the apps and the iPads and the stuff that they are absorbing as giant sponges through the internet, through. You know, through everything that's available to them, is amazing. I mean, it's just they learn more outside of school potentially than they do inside, and that's the great challenge to me. STEM, core, and everything else away is how are you going to break down that wall of status quo, the epitome of status quo, the school systems, where in Ohio they're more concerned with attendance and population because that means more tax dollars sent their way to not to spend the tax dollars correctly, but just to get more money into their coffers than they really are educated. And that's what I think the great challenge is going to be. I mean, come on, you give every kid a Kindle, you don't need a textbook anymore, do you? So then the textbook manufacturers, imagine how hard they're fighting to keep their lousy textbooks in these schools, the schools. I mean, I just can imagine the lobbying going on in every state, especially the state of California, which has the largest school system, and they usually, that what they buy usually dictates to the rest of the country what textbooks are going to be used. So I think, you know, I think it's a great potential to get rid of all that and reopen the educational systems better than we have been. And it's going to be a great thing, great potential landslide of knowledge coming to those who grab it becoming all of us becoming digital natives and using it correctly.
Okay, Gary, this is absolutely in your alleyway, shall we say. You know, do you think that the education system is too narrowly focused on STEM? You know, it would be better if we expanded it, you know, into boring things like history and geography and social skills.
I honestly, you know, I've been teaching at a master's level for the last 15 years, and it's pretty shocking. You know, the problem is so gigantic. I think it's more of a cultural problem than anything else. I'm going to be a little tangential here, but, you know, you watch these shows all the time. On how many shows can you watch on singers, on people who know how to sing? And, you know, and we spend all this time and all this attention, all this money, and we aggrandize all these things. And the Koreans are lapping us, and the Chinese are lapping us, and the Germans are lapping us. And we're just, you know, I think we're just a victim of our own success, and we've become fat and stupid. And I think, which is why we elected George Bush twice, but we are very much a stupid, fat country, and we're becoming more religious. And if you believe in religion, you don't need science. So I think it's a very much of a cultural shift. I don't know if we need just to hit rock bottom like the alcoholic does. I'm not sure. But as far as, you know, the actual basics of what to do, it's really a little bit out of my depth in that regard. It's just very discouraging, and I think somehow we need to value things different than some guy or some woman who could sing incredibly well. But with that, with my monologue, gentlemen, I'm going to go see my mother right now. So happy Mother's Day to all, and I'm stepping into a big Mother's Day celebration now. So I want to wish you all well, and Manny, nice talking to you. I haven't not talked to you before, but obviously you are a very eloquent and intelligent, so I hope to do it again with you.
Well, good. I'm going to talk to you again just so I can get another compliment. And if I had a mother, my mother's been dead for a number of years, I would do the same as you. So enjoy yourself and have a wonderful Mother's Day.
All right, man. Be well. Thank you very much. Be well, all. Bye-bye.
Adios. Thank you.
Let me come back to school for a moment. We can't let that one get too far. You know, when you talk about STEM, you have to understand that all this drive is driven by these huge contributions by basically Bill Gates. And the reason they're doing this is they're pushing this belief that they need to hire more math people to work within their businesses. And I throw in Google and all the rest. That's the reason why they are pressing math as hard as they are, is it's sort of a supporting system where they basically want to produce people who can only do what they need for their business. And it's in no way slanting towards any other profession in the United States. That's one of the biggest problems.
Okay. How is it fixed?
We got to wrest control. Basically, let's start at the beginning. All the major right-wing people from Philip Anschulz, the DeVos family, basically Gates and all the rest of them are basically trying to take over the school system so they can teach fundamentalist views. And it's back to a mantra you've heard from me for years about controlling the amount of political contributions by these people, what they spend their money on, and what they're able to influence by what they do. And so we're now at a point in our country where if we don't stop these people from what they're doing, we're going to have one heck of a problem. So it's a question of who puts the money in, and whoever spends the most amount of money usually prevails in the U.S., right?
Right.
Right. And this just, you know, bugs me no end. You know, I have nothing against the STEM idea, except I do, because you turn out a bunch of robots with absolutely zero social skills. There was a Nat Geo test given a number of years ago, and something like 50% of the people couldn't even find Canada on a world map. It makes me sad.
Yeah. Well, it's been around a while. I like to tell this joke. I was, I'm a car enthusiast, if you don't know, and I think most of you know. And I was up at a friend of mine's place that I grew up with up in the North San Fernando Valley, who customized a lot of my cars. So I'm having lunch. The whole crew's having lunch together, and they're talking, and my friend had served in Vietnam and around the world, and he was talking about being Italy, and I had just returned from a vacation. So we're talking, and one of the guys goes, "Where's Italy?" And my friend says, "Oh, come on. Yeah, let me draw a picture. You don't know where Italy is?" And they all look at it. There's six or seven guys, and they all kind of go, "Ugh." They all look just dumbfaced. And I'm sitting there going, "I don't believe what I'm watching." So he goes, "You know, the country that looks like a boot." And they all start looking at each other like, "Boot?" So then he starts trying other things. You ever Michelangelo? And they're all looking at each other like, "Ugh." And two or three minutes later, he had to go get a book out and show him where Italy was. And I go, "Oh, wow! I thought I was in some type of ward for the mentally ill. It was unbelievable." So it's not new. It's the poor quality of teaching that's going around, and the accent on things that aren't important. A Renaissance education? What's that anymore?
Okay, obviously, I have to let Sam vent a little bit.
I don't have, you know, my thing is, I come from a state where they do a thing called social promotion, okay? What is it? That they have to promote, no matter how bad your kids are education-wise, you have to promote them because that's how they keep getting money for the school system. And it's just so you socially promote them. It's bad for them to be held back, right? Got the idea of social promotion? You're socially retarding this young man or young woman if you will hold them back, whereas it probably might be a good thing for the kid to do that. So, but I agree, you know, Manny, I haven't read your stuff. I'm looking forward to it. I'm just getting my teeth into it, and I see, you know, the incredible, like, you know, the bureaucracies that are involved, that have, you know, sprung up, and just getting my licensing, listening to other teachers talk, some administrators with their hands tied, some who should have their hands tied, you know, and then you have these things called local school boards, which are about as effective as the United States Congress. You know, it's just not effective anymore, and we don't even need them. But they have, and they decide, and it's just, you know, I mean, you know, what's the big issue at the local school boards? Should we sell fracking rights under our football field? Because we need more revenue stream. And it's never about educating kids, and it hasn't been for a long, long time. And I yearn for it, so I got back involved in it. I'm glad I did. I'm hoping that things get better and to be a part of the process because, you know, I see these kids. And I know there's a lot of good teachers out there. All four of us know that. And we know there are kids who want to learn. But with the same token, you got to realize that, you know, the school systems have to change to meet the technology change. They have to. There has to be an incredible marriage in order for both to grow and both to get better. It sounds like, from Manny, what I'm going to be reading from you is that's going to require yet another revolution. And hopefully it'll happen. Because I think we'll all be better off for it. But, you know, and I can also see why teachers, you know, I've had to go into the inner city a couple times. of Youngstown, and I'm sure, you know, you talk about people who are underpaid. I don't even know how these teachers get up to get motivated to go into these classrooms where they're threatened, where the administrators are, you know, just hiding, probably drinking, more drugged out than whatnot, and most of the kids walking through the hallways are drug dealers and not going to school. And their age, you know, they're 13, 14, 15 years old. It's terrifying, but it's reality. It's just, I'm surprised there's not more school shootings based upon how many kids. I had a sixth grade a couple weeks ago. Almost every kid in the class had to go see the nurse, not because they had a bloody nose from the playground, not because but it was their medication time. It was like that scene from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I thought the lights would go off. Medication time, medication time. You know, Nurse Ratchet would come in and give them all the little ADD pills and whatnot. Or I had to remember that little Johnny had to take this pill. I mean, I'm talking an aspirin or a cough drop or something of that nature. And that goes back to what, you know, we've already discussed many times. Who's the biggest drug dealer in America? The pharmacist. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies. And that's a scary thing. You know, all these kids, have come with a note. This one's got ADD. This one has this. This one has that. Are you a teacher or are you a drug dealer? You know, are you a drug pusher? That's what I felt like.
Now,
so there's a lot of problems out there at every level. Is it any wonder why all these, you know, as these kids get older and pushed to a system that spits and chews them out, doesn't get them ready? Because unfortunately, those who have the money, have the withdrawal, have the education, maybe have an athletic talent, have an incredible academic talent, they're going to end up going to the right places. They're going to be helped along by their, it could be the wealth of their family, their own ability, that they're super smart, can become more intelligent through their schooling, or a gifted athlete or a gifted musician or a gifted actor or actress. They're going to have that ability to just so bypass the peers, and the peers are never going to catch up, and they're all stuck. What are they going to do for livings? That's what my question is. I look at all these kids. Where are they going to find jobs?
But, you know, that's how we got to where we are today, Sam, in our society, is exactly that description. And I want to, I have a question that's going to come over to Peter, is in discussing and looking at what you're saying, Sam, one of the issues is that money breeds greedy people. Here we have a school system that's falling apart, okay? We all agree that. But what happens is you see people that see profit in that. There's a quote from a Murdoch who says that, said basically, it's a $500 billion industry waiting for us to take it. And so with that attitude, with no interest at all in educating people, big business see this as a huge moneymaker, and they're treating it like it's a huge moneymaker. And as long as we're going to treat education as the moneymaker, it's never going to work. And that, to me, is the number one flaw in it. And the other part of it, too, is advantaged children always do well. They always find somebody. Somebody recognizes their talent, they push them out. From Mozart, who was an obvious talent at a young age, to even children today, people find ways to make that individual child progress in our society. It's the ones who don't. And those ones are in every generation. In my brother's generation, the 50s, they were called beatniks and everything else. They were basically kids who didn't want to learn, dropped out of school. That whole generation that Marlon Brando appealed to so much, and the Wild Ones and all the rest of it. Basically, countries pass over generations. And we are passing over another generation, and they're going to be lost. The same way when Ronald Reagan started changing things, did you notice that poverty was followed by Ebonics and other things that have not helped our country since? And I'm going to end it with this thought. As much as you complain about the education in Ohio, you grew up, at least you finished your days in high school in Ohio, you're an extraordinarily well-educated man. My wife, who grew up in Youngstown also, is extraordinarily bright and well-educated, et cetera, and yet the school system now is falling off from the level that you enjoyed when they were younger. So what we're seeing is a giant step backwards. Is that your observation? And Peter, do you also feel the same way about when things are short on money, it brings the vultures in?
Well, I agree with everything you said. I would just add one little wrinkle to it. You say that money brings out the greed in people, and I think that people are inherently greedy, period, and that the way we measure wealth today is by money. We talked about that earlier. You know, everybody believes that money is the great scorecard. Some people believe it more than others, but we have a world that is dedicated to pursuing money. If we had a world that believed in something else, we would pursue that. But everybody is out there trying to make a buck in one way or another. And some are doing it in different ways than others. But as long as you have a world ethos that is dominated by making money, you're going to have all of these problems, that we now see. And until the world has some other compass by which it measures success, and I don't know if it ever will, then you're just going to have the same problems repeating themselves over and over and over and over and over again, and that is people are fundamentally greedy. They're always going to pursue their self-interest. They're all about accumulating as much wealth as possible in one form or another, and it's always going to lead to these same problems, whether it's education or politics or pollution or drugs, whatever it is. It's just a never-ending saga, and I don't know how to possibly change it.
I wasn't even suggesting we change it. I think it's a force of nature. I call it the greed is good generation from the movie Wall Street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah. I mean, I used to always believe that the worst things got at the top, you know, because of people's greed or they don't care, that they would fall from within and a better system would take up. It would come up, and now I'm starting to believe that's just so naive on my part that it's going to be engulfed and devoured by the Bill Gateses of the world, the Koch brothers, as you guys both have said, those with the most money win, because that's what America's based on, and that's what our whole system is based on now, and it's only about them and their privileged few, and the rest of us be damned, because I think how do you start a revolution when most people want to watch the NFL draft as opposed to, you know what I mean? I mean, the NFL draft is more important than, you know, people really are taking part of in their communities and trying to than vote. More people probably watch the NFL draft than vote.
Well, but, you know, some of that, in all fairness, is the fact that people are looking for diversion. I mean, why did people in the middle of the Depression go see every Fred Astaire movie ever made? Because they couldn't cope with being at home and dealing with their own lives.
Okay, I agree. But, you know, also, and let me answer that, taking that cue, what did it cost to go to a movie back then?
10 cents.
Okay, with 10 cents, was that easy to come by or hard to come by, as opposed to go to a movie now where at Cinemax it's 10 bucks? Which is a lot of money.
Well, I think people in soup lines found every dollar hard to come by.
Right.
And I'll give you a comment from an older client of mine who fought the Flying Tigers in World War II. He used to say to me, Manny, never forget that only 38% of the country was unemployed during the Depression, and the rest of them were making a hell of a good living. And even though that's a horrifying number, 38% is basically four times what it is today, but the fact is it does leave an awful lot of people living good lives the same way we have a lot of people suffering today, but for every people who's suffering in this country right now, there's somebody out there living the good life, right?
Right, right.
So
especially if you watch, my wife was watching the show. You guys have it at Beverly Hills, at Southern California. She was watching the show yesterday. It was laughable, but it was a reality television show on Bravo where they follow real estate brokers around who are trying to close million-dollar deals in Manhattan.
And
for the summer, they're going to start one. It's got to be coming your way pretty soon. It's the most watched show Bravo right now, more than Real Housewives. And now they're starting to, they're going to do one in South Florida. You know, a million dollar, I forget what it was called. Just watching the size of these penthouses, the homes in Manhattan, how the brokers were doing it, the people they were dealing with, and the amounts of money, you know, $11 million for a townhouse or brownstone, you know, or this or that. And I was sitting there going, it just amazes me. Yeah, just what you guys are talking about, the greed, the this, the that, arguing over an $11 million deal, and the guy wanted, the buyer wanted two couches thrown in, and the seller was going absolute, was having a conniption that he wasn't going to throw in his two couches on an $11 million deal.
Yeah, I had
that was the most important thing to all three people, buyer, seller, and broker.
I guarantee you none of us can watch those things in Los Angeles. We all have better to do. I know when the show's on, because I know so many brokers in Beverly Hills professionally, that they just send me these notices. I'm going to be on TV showing property, tune in or whatever. I'm looking at it like, you got to be joking me. You know, you feel the same way, Peter. Would you watch a show on tours of Beverly Hills homes? First of all, if you know how to do it, you can do a visual tour of every house for sale in Beverly Hills without even watching the show. Every one of them is up on the internet.
Yeah, very true. These reality shows, Housewives, Million Dollar Listings, all
that's
this
it, Million
stuff.
Dollar Listings. That's the name of it. Thank you.
I represent a lot of real estate agents and brokers too, and I can't watch any of that reality stuff for very long. It turns my stomach. I have to watch something else.
Amen, Peter. Amen. And then
so how are they? Okay, guys. Then Manny, then it must be the word you use, diversion. Most people, you know, we might watch it just to see, okay, what is all the fuss about, realize it's tasteless, horrible, trash, and move on, right? Nothing to see here, folks. Move on. Obviously, the majority of the people who are watching it couldn't even get into the door. They couldn't even, the doorman wouldn't even let them in to the doorway, into the alcove on a freezing cold day, let alone even ever live in that
place.
Well,
Manny, you just answered your own question. Nothing to see here, nothing to see here, move on. But no matter how true that is, if you see an accident on the freeway, everybody stops to watch it, okay?
Sure.
They just can't help it. And there may be a few people who it makes queasy, but so many people will just – they'll stop to watch a spectacle, no matter how illogical it is. They'll just do it.
Well, I understand the rubbernecking thing, absolutely. But that you see, it's right there. I mean, it's right in front of you. It isn't reality TV. It is right there. It's a real thing, and I understand that. But these shows that these people can't watch, it must be exactly what you said. It's that Fred Astaire. It's that diversion, everything. I'm going to watch Real Housewives with Beverly Hills or Million Dollar Listings or souped-up cars or, you know, plastic surgeries and whatnot, because that's the life I want to live. And because I'm not living it, if they look around their home or their trailer or their whatever they live in, it's never going to be that way. So it is that diversionary. Yet,
I guarantee most of the audience for these shows are the people who cannot afford them or walk in the door, which is why they watch them. Is because they'll never see these homes any other way. And that is one of their motivations. And for those of us, Peter and I, we've been in enough expensive home. If I don't see another one, I wouldn't care. In fact, some of them aren't even though they're selling in Beverly Hills for a fortune, they wouldn't sell in my neighborhood for that. My home's nicer than theirs, you know, because just you can add about three zeros and a few decimal points for any home in Beverly Hills, irrespective of its quality. So a lot of these homes aren't the nicest homes that you're going to find in Los Angeles.
Well, it's funny. What I got out of it and my wife got out of it, you know, we live in a house. We live in a little village. There's 800 people in it. Our house was built in 1842 and added on, totally updated by the people we bought it from. I wouldn't trade it for... You know, I mean, we have a garden, you know, not like yours, Manny, with tomatoes, with the flowers and all that. He was the guy who renovated it was a big florist. Our garden is incredible. It's a stone garden with lots of flowers around it. But anyway,
I don't have your weather, Sam, so go ahead.
But when we got out of it, you know, like right now, like it's Mother's Day, we got like, you know, we got like 12 different kinds of tulips growing up. I don't have to buy my wife flowers, just to go sit out on the bench in the yard, you know. But the wonderful thing about it is what I got, it's kind of weird, it's like I appreciated my home in the 15 minutes I walked Million Dollar Listings in Manhattan so much more. In the little community I live in. Now, I know that sounds, it might sound weird, but it did. It was like, wow, I'm really happy where I live, in my home and this and that, and that's what I got out of it. And, of course, how disgusting, you know, that the real estate brokers are still sleazy and, you know, the only thing they're not wearing are plaid jackets and looking like that guy from WKRP. What was his name?
I forgot the...
you know the guy I'm talking Hussman, about, the salesman?
Yeah, Hussman played him, and I can't think of his name.
He was hilarious, though.
Howard, what's his name, played him. And you know, it's funny because I'm amazed sometimes at what my wife will watch on television, including The Good Wife, for which we're lawyers, maybe one of the worst shows ever on TV. She was watching the other night. I crawled in bed. I just wanted to go to sleep. So I turned over to sleep. She was watching The Good Wife. And about 2 minutes, I turned around and said, this is the dumbest lawyer show I've ever seen in my life. I've never heard so many dumb things. Ashley just walked in. She heard me rapping on Good Wives. I mean, they actually, people believe that's what happens in the practice of the law. Doesn't that gall you, Peter?
Oh, well, look, you can't get me to watch a show about the practice of law without falling out of my chair. You know, but it's like any attempt to create a television show for what happens in the real world. The real world isn't dramatic enough for TV, so they mix it up. But it drives me nuts. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, this is my dear sweet wife who won't watch a doctor's show because they infuriate her.
But she'll watch a lawyer show.
She'll watch a lawyer show, but she won't watch a doctor's show.
So you have to watch the doctor's show.
I can't watch a doctor's show either, but, you know.
When are we going to get it? Is there a reality TV show, speaking of this, with why not have a real, follow Peter Haven into court and watch lawyers go at each other? I'm not talking about Judge Judy, but the real ones. But the court systems wouldn't allow that, would they?
Oh, it goes on all the time. That's called court TV.
Those aren't those for, like, small claims cases?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Look what CNN did with, what's the name, Casey Anthony. That had to be one of the great lawyer shows ever.
That's true. That was a great one. Or the Trevon Martin case.
Oh, yeah. You know, and it's funny because people like Peter and I look at them and we realize how many bad lawyers there are out there.
Okay. I'm looking at the clock, and there's one more subject that I want to bring up. Because I really, really want to get your thoughts on it. Yep, Benghazi. This is the gift that just won't stop giving. Who has any comments on the GOP's latest move? Let's do what I believe is the 16th investigation into the event. 14th. Oh, I'm sorry. My math was wrong. And
well, let me give you the numbers, Simon. I actually got the numbers out to read to you because you gave me some warning. There have been 4 major investigations, 8 lesser investigations, and 1 that's starting. They had a total of 13 congressional hearings, 50 briefings, 25,000 pages of documents, and they've all come up with 0. So let's jump in from there.
Right. Well, okay. Is it worth, you know, prodding the cow one more time?
Well, anyone want to comment?
I defer to Sam.
I think enough is enough. You know, I mean, it's the cost. It's the cost. I mean, is there a smoking gun there? I think it came out already. That's what I don't understand. The smoking gun is Four people were killed. They shouldn't have been killed. And the administration at the time was afraid they were going to be labeled too weak on terror or something of that nature. They paraded out a public relations campaign that was a disaster. The most Americans realized it was full of crap. And in retrospect, they probably wish they didn't do it because they were going to win the election anyway. And that's what they worried about. And now it's all that's that. You know, it was a bad deal. What happened? And I realized that they probably shouldn't have. That Hillary and they should have been paying more attention. That the Arab Spring that Obama was embracing and that as things were going to happen great around the world and it was a good thing. You know, it didn't happen. The fundamentalist crazies are all out there. And they got their hands on weapons. They're going to kill Americans. You know, it's happened. And it happened in Iran. It happened. Reagan had 200 Marines killed in Beirut. And so wherever the ugly American has been, the forces of bad, when they could, of revolutionary forces, have tried to take us out. I think is there an impeachable offense here? No, I think there's a stinkable offense on both sides. One is that the Obama administration didn't judge this thing correctly, then they put the spin on it, typical modern-day American politics, and the Republicans can't let it go because they see it as a great issue, and it's about as great an issue on an election year as impeaching a president who had sex with that woman that he said he didn't have sex with, and who now gets paraded out into the front again. Like, talk about living in the past, and that's what's going on. I think they should let it go. And people realize that, you know, it was a bad thing. And I like to think so. Why they hang on to it, I do not know. They see it as this great issue. And who's ever giving them their spin cards, and I guess it must be Karl Rove and Fox News, is okay. Because the guy, you know, it's not going to win them the midterm elections, the issue of Benghazi. It's not. I don't know why they don't get that, but I guess, you know, they don't call me up to ask my opinion. I hope they listen to the show, and they might learn a thing or two or three.
Okay.
Sam, I have a stat for you, Sam. He is the sixth ambassador to die since 1968 violently, but the only one we really talk about or listen to. Not only do I agree with you that it's a political issue, but the simple fact is we're at war, and people, generals, other people kill people stupidly. I mean, look at the Light Brigade. There's no greater stupid stunt than Tennyson's Light Brigade in Crimea in the 1850s. But this is basically an opportunity to lambast Obama, and they haven't given up on it. But what we're dealing with is we're going to lose more people in these things because we're spread out too thin. And in the case of Chris Stevens, he had a reputation for being reckless all the way back to Lebanon, wouldn't sit in his office. And what's missed in this story, because it's the last thing I want to point out with the time running, is, you know, he died of smoke inhalation in a safe room from some type of grenade. The smoke got under the door, however, or got in the air conditioning system. So he didn't die from gorillas. He died because the safe room was properly, safely ventilated, and he died. So to make this anything other than sadly, he died in war, and to me, he's no greater death than any Marine that has died in the last 2 months or has died in the last 12 or 13 years. And that's the sad part.
Okay. But also this week, Monica rears her ugly head.
That is an ugly head.
Yeah, I'm beginning to wonder, oh, it's a PR campaign. Yeah, obviously two very different subjects, but that there is a point of contact, Hillary Clinton. Is this all just a PR deal by the GOP?
What the timing of it, of course. Anything that I'm sure that they finance the book. anything to embarrass the Democrats, they're for. And what's happened with it's galling so many of them is that Clinton's rehabilitated himself and become a major force, and he was a major force in Obama being reelected, and that has to gall them too because they thought they put him on the sideline permanently, right, Sam?
Yeah, I think so. I think Clinton's done a nice job rehabilitating himself. And, again, the Republicans are stupid. Gee, what a surprise. Bill Clinton's soft underbelly is he was the beginning. He opened the floodgates for Fannie and Freddie Mae and the housing bubble.
And NAFTA.
Wealth, what?
And NAFTA. He pushed
and NAFTA. NAFTA, yeah. Rothwell, and yet he comes into Ohio where he sold out all the jobs. And, you know, they treat him like a conquering, you know, like they put palm leaves in front of him and her. And they were for that. And those are the issues that they should be going after. But they don't. You know, they're just stupid when it comes to this stuff. And, like many of you pointed out, all across our country, the world, we lose American servicemen and women who are serving the country, not just in wartime, but they're in embassies, they're whatever they are in this giant war out there. And nothing against Stevens and the three other people, but they're the casualties in this war. But there's so many other ones over the years that have happened. And they keep making a big deal out of it. And again, I don't know why the Democrats don't push back with what you and I just said. Well, where was the investigation into the Lebanon Marine barracks bombings by Reagan? Where was the investigation into the other ambassadors who got assassinated and murdered?
Well,
you don't talk about.
Let me add one that galls me. How about Bush lying and trying to pass off Tillman's death as friendly fire?
Oh, absolutely.
Have you ever seen the documentary?
It's incredible.
Oh, it galled me from start to finish.
Yep. I think the guy who thinks he shot him just came out. Oh, he was interviewed somewhere. I saw his interview online. He's the ranger who thinks he's the one who killed Tillman by friendly fire. I agree with you. I mean, how many – and look, friendly fire has been a casualty. I mean, Stonewall Jackson got killed by friendly fire, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, we're talking – it's one of those – horrific things that happens in wartime, but to gain political cover or political favors for it, is despicable. But I guess those are the red herrings that they throw out as diversionary things. So we don't pay attention to the real items. Look at us. We talked about Sterling and the NFL draft more than we talked about what's going on in the Ukraine. So I guess we're guilty of it, too.
Yeah. I'm going to end with this. Ashley pointed at my wife, for those who don't know, Ashley Brooks, pointed out something to me this morning at breakfast that had me howling in a negative way. There was a survey done by the Republicans that they described as their postmortem or autopsy of the previous election. And you know what their conclusion was and why they lost the election? Is too much free speech by Republicans.
Well, too many debates, wasn't it?
Too many, but the quote was there was too much free speech, yes. That was the official thing, but basically that's what they were saying. Too much free speech.
Yeah, I read that they were going to limit the amount of debates the next couple of years because they thought they hurt each other with all that stuff. I think, why wouldn't you want as many debates as possible?
Well, because to steal a street expression, because Republicans like to step on their dick. is there a better street expression than that one?
Is the public ready for mass debates?
Oh, Simon.
He has been
Simon.
Punt.
He's really been on point today, huh?
You...
He really has been on death.
Wow.
I love it. Gentlemen, thank you for welcoming me back. I'll try to join you when I can. I finished the first major draft of my book. It's off to be edited. It's called Corporocracy for those people who've suffered through it. Peter, if you'd like, I'll send you some chapters. And
please do.
Because I know you have absolutely nothing else to do in your life, right?
I got nothing but free time.
Gentlemen, this has been a wonderful discussion, and I can honestly say it wasn't a mass debate.
But it was a wonderful time. Thank you, gentlemen. Manny, always a pleasure. I really wish we have one of the few beautiful days we've had for Mother's Day, I'm glad to say. I really would have liked to have been reading your book out in the sun today, but I got to read it online right now. And I thank you for the drafts. It's wonderful, but I'm still one of those guys that needs to have a book in his hand when he's sitting outside. Not a Kindle, not a laptop, any of that stuff, but I understand that is the future, and the future is now.
No, the future is you and I are getting paid 50 cents or $1 a book. We sold 70 of one of our books last month, and when I saw the check from Amazon for the Kindle books, I almost threw up. So
I got one. It was $1.49.
Wow.
And I had 14 books sold on Kindle sold in the UK. I know that in the UK market, and I came back after they ripped, and did the conversion. I got $1.49. But the good thing is, they're selling. And that's all I keep saying to myself. Hey, someone's reading my book. I get reviews every once in a while posted. So I can't pitch, and they're pretty positive.
Yeah. That's all we can have.
And,
hey, Manny, who knew?
Simon's trying to sign off, and we're killing him.
Peter, your parting thoughts and... you know, are you planning a book?
No, I'm not planning a book, but I just keep going back to that expression of Manny's about stepping on your you-know-what. Let me tell you something. It hurts.
I may have started something here.
Everybody got their 2 cents in today.
Yeah, Peter, I miss you. I look forward to talking to you soon.
Miss you all, too. Love you like brothers.
Take it easy, guys. You guys on the West Coast, enjoy your other 3 hours that you have that are gone on my side. Simon, enjoy your other hour that you have.
Okay. This is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy, healthy, and safe week. We'll be back again next week. Till then, goodbye.